Feeling stressed this morning? Try this.
Try and sit up tall so you can shrug your shoulders up towards your ears as you inhale. And then exhale, go ahead, release the shoulders back down.
That moment of calm from NPR is something you might be hearing in more Illinois schools thanks to a number of mindfulness initiatives across the state. Today we talked to a researcher and practitioners teaching teachers to be more present. Plus, the Department of Energy has invested more than $100 million in a new bioenergy center at the University of Illinois, one of just four in the country. Here's its new director, Evan De Lucia.
What bioenergy means and what the objective of our center is to develop new types of crops that can generate replacements for fossil fuels.
But first, yesterday the state Senate overrode a veto by Governor Rauner that could have held up equitable funding for public schools. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st, this first day of February. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last summer, Illinois agreed to overhaul the way it funds its public schools. A reminder, we've had the most inequitable system of funding in the country. That deal also included a new tax credit that would make up to $100 million in donations available to those for private school scholarships. A few weeks ago, though, Governor Rauner vetoed that bill that would have paved the way for the education overhaul to take effect. He said in his amendatory veto that the standards for private schools to be included in the tax scholarship credit should be changed. That decision could have held up equitable funding for public schools in the rest of the state. But yesterday, both the House and the Senate overrode Governor Rauner's veto. We're joined now by State Senator Jennifer Bertino-Tarrant. She's a Democrat representing Illinois' 49th Senate District. That covers parts of the Southwest Chicago suburban area. She's also chair of the Senate Education Committee. Senator Bertino-Tarrant, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Do you feel confident now that public schools will be getting money under the new funding formula this fiscal year?
Definitely. I think all along that we knew that the new dollars, and again, we have to remember that we are talking about the new dollars, the additional $350 million that was allocated when the bill was passed, the new funding formula was passed, that they would get the money. All this veto did was create a delay, a bit of confusion, a little more uncertainty, things that we have dealt with continually for the last 3 years for our schools. It gives our public school districts peace of mind, once again, that we are all on the same page and our priority is getting these new dollars to our public schools.
I want to address some of that confusion and uncertainty in a minute, but I just want to ask you what timeline we're looking at now in terms of where are we with funding and the new funding formula and dollars? When will that start flowing? Do we have a sense of that?
We do. I think originally the thought was going to be sometime in March. From what I understand, talking to the State Board of Education, we are looking more realistically into April. Some of that is because of possibly the veto. Other is because of the dynamics of the bill, one including enrollment of students. So there were some guidelines set in the bill that requires three-year averages. So we are just They are just completing some of those averages right now.
I wanted to ask you about some other parts of this that have been a little confusing for, I think, people who maybe haven't been following it closely. There was this veto that was related to private school eligibility for the tax credit. Last week, the State Board of Education and the Department of Revenue came up with a compromise on this issue. And meanwhile, though, as we've talked about it on the program in the past, last week we had a superintendent on from Decatur, a private school superintendent, who was talking about the rollout of this tax credit and how it's happening very quickly. The implementation of this has moved very quickly. They didn't even have, to my knowledge, they hadn't even had the paperwork yet for parents to file for applications, even though the deadline was supposed to happen. Can you explain a little bit about what's happening with also this tax credit and what's going on with that?
All right. Well, yeah, to acknowledge the fact that the governor vetoed an education funding bill, that had to deal with a request from his administration, and then added a component that was completely different than what the bill was doing. Just shows you know, the erroneous nature of this governor. Again, he has a one-track mind. His goal was to get that tax credit for his friends, and that has been his focus. I've never seen the Department of Revenue work so quickly to get a program up and running. However, with that said, from what I understand, the governor fixed the problem with the Illinois State Board of Education, so the veto wasn't even necessary.
So to your mind, the veto wasn't necessary. We have, Well, just because we've heard from, I'm just curious, because we've heard from private schools a lot of confusion about eligibility. You're saying you think that's been cleared up now?
Well, the eligibility was set out set forth when we created the bill, when that aspect of the bill over that long weekend was created. There's definitely going to be confusion. It was an 11th-hour add-on. And there is not enough time to vet the bill, think of long-term pictures. So there's no doubt there is going to be confusion with the tax credit program. They've tried to establish who can apply for it. They have developed geographical regions where different, depending on how much of the money they take in, is allocated to these different areas. But when you throw something together so quickly, you are definitely going to have immediate problems. You know, you even look at the education funding bill. That was over 3-4 years. And we still know we're going to have trailers to tweak some things. When you do things in a weekend or two, there's no doubt there's going to be problems. And the people that are going to, it's going to impact, and the people that it's intended to serve are going to be the very ones that are going to be hurt.
We just have a minute or two left, Senator, but I wanted to ask, do you think we should be worried about the implementation of the entire education funding haul, including both the new formula and the tax credit?
My priority is public school funding. The Constitution of Illinois says we demand that we fund public education, and that should be our priority. I have a bill out there that says exactly that the tax credit cannot be implemented until we ensure that the minimum funding is given to school. It does not take away the scholarship program. As I understand, there's already been dollars donated to the program. Those dollars can still be distributed. However, a tax credit for donors cannot take priority over funding for our public school students.
Senator, I spoke to your colleague, Senator Menar, about this a couple weeks ago. He indicated some frustration with this. You sound pretty frustrated yourself with how this is all turned out.
It really is. You mentioned in your opening that we have the worst funding system in the nation for our students, and we created the legislative advocate groups throughout the state created a system that is addressing that. And it becomes unfortunate when other dimensions get added on to meet the needs of individual people. And this is really what I feel took place over those last couple weekends when we were trying to finish up a solid education bill.
That's Senator Jennifer Bertino Tarrant. She's the Senate Education Committee Chair. She also represents Illinois' 49th Senate District, joining us to talk about the Senate override yesterday of Governor Rauner's veto. The House override voted as well. Senator Bertino Tarrant, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. You have a good day.
We hear a lot about sustainability in today's world, but when it comes to a new center at the University of Illinois, the Department of Energy is putting its money where its mouth is. They're investing $115 million over the course of 5 years in a new bioenergy research center in Urbana, one of only four in the United States. The center, also called CABI, hopes to address questions of how to provide sustainable sources of energy as the world continues to grow. And held a kicked-off celebration this morning. Earlier, I had a chance to catch up with the new director of the Center for Advanced Bioenergy and Bioproducts Innovation, Evan De La Silla, who's also the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and in the Environment. Hi, Evan. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
So this new center is, I mentioned, one of four Department of Energy research hubs on bioenergy. We're talking about $115 million being invested. Before we get to the details, I thought we should maybe start with some basics. And maybe you can just even just explain to lay folk what bioenergy means.
What bioenergy means and what the objective of our center is to develop new types of crops that can generate replacements for fossil fuels, that they can grow various types of oils in their body, and that we can extract those oils either directly as fuels or as other types of value-added products. Think about jet fuels. Think about biodiesels. Think about plastics. Maybe even pharmaceuticals down the road.
And why is it oil and the oil of plants?
So oil is can act as a direct replacement for fossil fuels. So that's kind of the first step. We already extract biodiesel from soybean. Of course, that's a food crop. So when we're using soybean to make fuel, we're not feeding people with it. So our focus is on non-food crops and being able to develop fuels and bioproducts in non-food crops.
And so when you say the focus is on developing products, is it more, are you going to be doing more research to help enable product development or actual product development?
This is basic research. So the Department of Energy has made a huge initial investment in us, which we're very excited about. And this investment really is to help the country and the Midwest lay a foundation for a new bioeconomy. In other words, how can we harness the power of biology to get plants to produce products that we don't typically think of? We're really good at growing corn and beans. And so think about diversifying that farming portfolio to build other kinds of products.
Like what?
Well, we talked about oils, various types of substrate chemicals. CABI has a three-part mission. Part of it is the feedstock mission, which is building new kinds of plants. And we're focusing very strongly on grasses to begin with. And then I guess the best analogy is think about sugarcane. Sugarcane plants grow. They produce lots of sugar in their body. And we squeeze the plant and get that sugar out and sell it.
Well, there's a lot of energy, right, that comes from sugarcane projects, which I should say I know a lot of because my family's from the Caribbean. So
you know a lot
I feel
about
like I know a lot about sugarcane,
yeah.
Right? But there are a lot of things that we get from sugarcane,
right?
Where there's rum, molasses, sugar,
you bet.
Lots of. Mm-hmm. So, and when you're thinking about focusing on grasses, why grasses in particular?
Let's just go back to sugarcane just for a minute. So imagine that you could reorganize that metabolism not to put all that extra carbon into sugar, but in some types of sugarcane, putting it into other kinds of high-value products. So what we're already doing with sugarcane is a very good model for what we're looking at. Now, grasses are really good crops because they are big. They produce a lot of biomass, so they can produce a lot of product. They're also, particularly the perennial grasses like sugarcane, like miscanthus, are perennials. What that means is you don't plant them every year. They just, like the grass in your lawn, come back after winter. So the nitrogen inputs, the fertilizer inputs, are very much reduced. The need for tillage, turning over the ground to plant, is very much reduced. And that's where the major environmental costs come with our intensive row crops like corn and beans.
So is the idea that eventually you would like to see, if you're talking about a new bioenergy economy of the Midwest or of Illinois, farmers planting these types of grasses instead of just corn and soy?
I think this would be a fantastic thing from the farming perspective because it would give the farmer some resilience and independence from variation in commodity prices. So imagine, and I'm really kind of reaching down the road a little bit, but imagine a 1,000-acre farm, 800 acres is in the corn-bean rotation, and a farmer now has 200 acres on contract producing a high-value bioenergy or bioproduct crop. That's going to give him financial stability that he or she doesn't currently have.
That's down the road. What's the plan right now for the research that you're doing? And as I said, this is just one of four in the country.
The whole institute has three parts to it. So the feedstock group's immediate plan, and they've already made some nice steps down this road, is to start reorienting the metabolism of grass stems. That's the feedstock group. The conversion group works with microorganisms, and you can imagine that the feedstock group might find it easy to build a certain type of compound, compound A, but the markets really want compound B. We can't quite get the plant to build compound B. The conversion group will use microorganisms to convert Compound A to Compound B. The third part of the Institute is the Sustainability Group. All of this needs to be nested in a context that's both environmentally sustainable and economically sustainable. So that's kind of the whole picture for CABI.
Why do you think University of Illinois was selected?
That's a good question, and I have a lot of reasons for that. One was that we took a very different approach to bioenergy than our three sister centers. Our approach is built, as you might have surmised, on the plants as factories paradigm, getting the plant to build the product in its body. Our sister institutes do a more traditional approach, which is to grow a plant. You know, plants are made mostly of, I'm going to use a big word now, lignocellulose. That's basically paper and wood. And then they take the lignocellulose and they break it down and they build products from that. Breaking down lignocellulose is quite difficult. And so we've spent a lot of money and a lot of time on what they call deconstruction. We're going to skip that step. And we're going to try to build the product directly in the plant body. So we had a novel idea. So that was a big part of us getting it. But the other piece is what I call the Illinois value proposition. We have an enormously rich community of plant scientists, synthetic biologists, computational biologists, ecologists, and economists on this campus, more than most. So that was a good thing. The university has also invested heavily in the energy farm. We have a farm dedicated to growing and exploring energy crops. So those are a couple of the reasons that we had a leg up over the other competitors.
Evan DeLucia is the new director of the Center for Advanced Bioenergy and Bioproducts Innovation at the University of Illinois. Just announced this morning, a $115 million investment over the next 5 years in this new bioenergy research center at the University of Illinois. Evan, thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Nella.
Back to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. According to the National Institutes of Health, more than 18 million Americans are meditating and engaging in mindfulness on a regular practice. So it shouldn't be surprising to hear that our youngest Americans, children, are getting in on the practice too. There's growing scientific evidence behind mindfulness and the benefits of meditation, including a renewed sense of focus, stress and anxiety management, not to mention coping with trauma and physical health benefits like lowering your blood pressure. And how schools are looking at this issue is what we're going to talk about now. Schools in Illinois have an incentive to this. 2 years ago, Senate Bill 100 gave districts a year to ban zero-tolerance disciplinary policies and investigate other intentions as well. So how mindfulness can be a preventative tool for disciplinary measures is another issue. Joining me now are two mindfulness educators who work with teachers and students. They're working particularly in the Urbana-Champaign area. Jason Scott is the president of the Mindful Teacher Foundation. Mia Donovan is one of the foundation's instructors. Both of them are here with me in our Urbana studio. Hi, welcome to
Hello.
The 21st.
Thank you for having us.
On the line from Chicago, I'm joined by Amanda Moreno. She's an assistant professor at the Erickson Institution. Amanda's in the middle of a multi-year study on mindfulness practices at Chicago Public Schools classrooms, the first of its kind, looking at elementary students in high poverty areas. Amanda, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me. Sorry I couldn't be there in the studio with you.
But that's okay.
For the discussion.
Jason, so mindfulness is a word we hear a lot now.
Right.
What does it mean, and particularly when you're talking about kids in a classroom?
Right. So mindfulness is a particular way of paying attention, a deliberate way of paying attention. Specifically to what's arising in the present moment in your sensory experience. So if you think about the five senses, what you feel in the body, what you hear, see, taste, etc. And it's doing so with an attitude of openness and curiosity to whatever is coming up, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant.
Mia, how do you explain that to kids?
We like to begin with an experience of mindfulness with kids. So we engage them in a listening practice with a chime or some sort of percussion instrument and encourage them to focus all their attention, their hearts and their minds on the sound. And we also begin with a mindful eating practice in which they eat a piece of fruit mindfully. So you,
and so what does that mean when you say they're eating a piece of fruit mindfully?
So, you know, they have an apple in front of them and we ask them, what do you see? What colors do you see? And they'll say, you know, red. Well, what else do you see? And then we sort of encourage them to look very closely and notice all the different colors they see. And then we, you know, bring the apple to our nose. What do we smell? See if we can describe that without using the word apple. And then we slowly take a bite and without chewing, move the apple piece around in our mouth. And kids love this. It really engages them. So we're using our five senses. And then after we've allowed them to experience a mindfulness practice, we explain that mindfulness is paying attention here and now with kindness and curiosity. And so they usually respond pretty well to that.
Amanda, what made you want to research mindfulness? Was this something that you practiced?
No, I did not come to this world through having my own mindfulness practice or being a yoga practitioner or anything like that. I came to it as a researcher from the discovery that a lot of the programs that had been trying to sort of access and help improve some of these kind of self-regulation skills in kids weren't working. And I don't know exactly why that is, but my idea about why that might be has something to do with the difference between thinking and feeling. And it seemed to me that mindfulness has this unique power in helping to kind of reach kids through a more visceral, kind of sensory, guttural level first, without sort of trying to get them to, you know, access the highest levels of their cognition all the time. So the way this might look in like a traditional, like social emotional type of program that does not use the mindfulness approach, for example, is they might say something like, you know, next time you have a fight with your friend on the playground, what would you do differently? And those are important skills, but it's hard to kind of start there, right? You're asking kids to project themselves into the future, and that's really a high-level cognitive skill. Whereas by focusing on the present moment, by focusing on your breath, by focusing on how does this feel right now in this moment, getting kids to slow down first, it gets them to actually feel it first, which then sort of opens them up a little bit to be able to start thinking about those more future-oriented processes.
That's Amanda Marino. She's an assistant professor at the Erickson Institute on the line from Chicago talking to us about this. Jason Scott, the Mindful Teacher Foundation is working in Unit 4 schools and the Urbana School District, so in Urbana-Champaign, K through 12. When did that program start, and what are you specifically doing?
Well, we are right now in the middle of our third year of programming, and we have a course called Mindful Teacher, Mindful Kids, and this is offered through the professional development programs of both districts, so teachers can sign up to participate. And it's offered, it's a 24-hour course, 24 instructional hours that's offered over the course of the entire year. So we have about 19 sessions that that participants complete. And the first half is really just about the core mindfulness skills, so learning how to do the practice for yourself. And in the second half of the program, we provide teachers with different resources and strategies and materials that they can use to bring mindfulness into the classroom.
And so, Amanda, while these things that Jason's talking about, these techniques, are things that have been used for centuries, the research supporting this is somewhat new, and I wanted to ask you about that. The University of Chicago Crime Lab has been studying the effects of meditation and quiet time in partnership with the David Lynch Foundation.
Your study is a 5-year program with some funding from the Department of Education. You mentioned something earlier. What do we know about mindfulness and how it helps, particularly as you're talking about what you're looking at? You're looking at elementary students in high poverty areas. You're talking about conflict resolution. What do we know now?
There is actually a lot we know so far. We don't really know why mindfulness works. You know, I provided some ideas earlier about why that would be. But I would say we know pretty well that it is effective at the outcomes that researchers have been looking at. They've been looking at things like social emotional skills, self-regulation skills, executive function, which is kind of the more cognitive version of self-regulation skills, and even into academics. So, for example, Goldie Hawn has a mindfulness program called Mind Up. And that has, you know, a gold standard randomized controlled trial associated with it, showing that the program even helps kids, you know, into their academic skills. So, you know, relative to a lot of other, you know, educational research, which is always messy and complicated and difficult, I would say that mindfulness is right in there as far as showing a lot of promise for being a good tool to add to the repertoire. So it's not to say that we would throw out the other things. It's not to say that we wouldn't do some more cerebral types of social and emotional work as well. But mindfulness seems to have a special kind of power to it that gives a little bit of structure and format and sort of public acceptance of taking a pause and taking a breath that seems to be really effective for kids.
And so,
Well, I was just going to say you could think about like an anxious child, for example. Like often we think of the disruptive child first, but if you think of the anxious child who, you know, they're not being disruptive, they're just sitting there being nervous, you could imagine that knowing that a mindfulness exercise was going to be coming up pretty soon because their teacher endorses that and agrees with that and encourages it, that would be somewhat reassuring to them. They know that they're going to get that, you know, coming up pretty soon.
And so in terms of your research, Amanda, you decided to focus on certain CPS, Chicago Public School, high poverty areas on the South and West Side. Some of these children are more at risk to being exposed to long-term stress. Certainly when we talk about gun violence and the traumatic effects of that in certain communities, I don't know if you have any statistical evidence yet. It sounds like I know you're at the beginning of this, but what ways have you also seen mindful and calming techniques be effective in these circumstances?
Well, I've definitely seen it up close and personal. I mean, I've been in school buildings, my staff have been in school buildings right in the middle of a lockdown because there's been a shooting down the block. You know, I don't want to overpromise and say that a mindfulness technique cures that problem by any means. Of course, we need social justice initiatives to be keeping going, you know, right alongside all this work. But certainly, again, knowing that there's this idea that in this community, it's okay. It's okay to feel what you're feeling. It's okay to take a pause from our academic work and just feel our breath and get calm together. And you know, process these feelings, whether they're bad or good. I've definitely seen it have a positive impact. And I've also noticed in our work that we do with parents that parents, you know, intuitively seem to understand this. And in fact, they crave more of it. So they say to us, wow, I really need this. So all the normal stresses of life are happening in terms of homework and bedtime. But of course, when you live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of poverty, a lot of violence, you know, even the daily normal stressors become that much more difficult. And it looks like mindfulness has a lot of promise for, you know, taking that edge off and allowing the coping to begin.
Mia, so that's Amanda's perspective for Chicago and for CPS. What are you seeing with teachers and with parents? Well, Amanda was mentioning parents and children. What are you seeing in the Urbana-Champaign area in terms of what are you hearing from people about how it's helping their student population?
We've had a lot of positive response from the teachers who have been in our program, who've gone through our course, for themselves, not only for their students, but for themselves. And actually, as Jason mentioned, the first part of our course, we really focus on the teachers, because a teacher is in the classroom and there's so much going on in there. So many students requiring their attention. They're trying to teach a lesson and then there's distractions going on. And so if the teacher herself or himself can be in a mindful place, they are able to better able to respond to the students' needs and create a classroom community that's positive for those students. And then for kids, kids seem to really enjoy mindfulness practices. They seem to kind of respond very naturally. It's sort of a natural state for them to be enjoying the moment. And so, building on that, I think is really, there's an opportunity for that.
Jason, to that point, is it different to teach mindfulness to, so when you're teaching teachers, how do you have the teachers teach students? Is it different depending on what age you're at, the way that you're talking about these techniques?
And this was something that we learned very early on as we were implementing the program, was that because we're working with such a broad range of teachers in the context, specific context that they're working within. So we have teachers from across the K-12 spectrum, so kindergarten teachers and high school teachers, we have counselors and social workers and school psychologists, even librarians and administrators. So how each of these educators is going to work with mindfulness in their specific context with the kinds of students and the needs that they're addressing is going to be very different, which is why we went from, say, teaching a curriculum to really teaching a collection of different strategies that can be applied. Because some teachers might just want a 3-minute mindfulness exercise that they can do after lunch or after, after PE or recess. And others, we had some counselors who were interested in putting together an after-school program, so wanting a more in-depth curriculum that they could apply.
We just have a minute or two left. So, Jason, I wanted to ask you really quickly. We were just talking about school funding earlier in the show. Some people might hear about programs like this and think meditation, that sounds like a luxury. Right. What's your response to that?
Well, it was our strategy early on, especially when we got started, and there was not a whole lot of awareness about mindfulness. So we structured the Mindful Teacher Foundation as a nonprofit entity. So what we do is a large part of activity is raising funds to offer these programs free of charge to the districts. And so right now, in our first year, we were funded by a grant from the Illinois Children's Healthcare Foundation. And at this point, our programs are sustained by donors. So people within the community, people and businesses within the community are providing the funding that we need to implement these programs.
Amanda, what about you? As I said, we just have about a minute left, but when you're thinking about CPS and the investment in mindfulness, why do you think that it's an important thing?
Well, I have to say, we're actually pretty lucky with CPS. Despite all the budget craziness and the difficulties that have happened in the district, they've maintained their social-emotional learning as a priority. And they've allowed the Calm Classroom program and our project, into the doors to be able to do that. Now, of course, we did bring in some external funding, for the research part of it. But in terms of ongoing, it seems that they're maintaining this as a priority, that schools need to have some kind of social and emotional approach. Just like they need to have a math curriculum and a literacy curriculum, they need to have this. And so we're just grateful that, that the mindfulness angle on that has been, allowed into the door and seems to be taking hold.
That's Amanda Moreno. I want to thank her. She's at the Erickson Institute, and she's in the middle of a multi-year study, the first of its kind, looking at elementary students in high-poverty areas studying mindfulness practices at Chicago Public Schools. I also want to thank Jason Scott with the Mindful Teacher Foundation. They're working in the Urbana-Champaign School District area, and Mia Donovan, who also is with the Mindful Teacher Foundation. All of you, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, we started airing our interviews with candidates for Illinois Attorney General. Our current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, is not running for re-election. There are 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans who would like to take her place. The primary is on March 20th. So here's how we did this. In interest of fairness, we asked all of the candidates more or less the same questions, kind of like a job interview, and we recorded everything in advance to give no one an unfair advantage. We're also airing them in random order over the next few weeks. Today, we're hearing from Aaron Goldstein. He's a supervising attorney with the Cook County Public Defender's Office. He's also a committeeman in Chicago's 33rd Ward on the city's north side. He's one of 8 Democrats, as I mentioned, running for attorney general. Aaron Goldstein, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So you're known for your work in part as a defense attorney for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Rooting out corruption is, of course, the goal or one of the goals of a state attorney general. Why did you want to switch to head the prosecutorial side of things?
Well, the attorney general, while it does have a prosecutorial role, it has a much broader role. It has the ability and the power to work on some of the main issues that I care about and I think the citizens of the state of Illinois care about, and that's standing up to these big powers, Donald Trump and the big corporations and the big banks, as well as criminal justice reform, which is something very important in our state, as well as something that I have seen every single day, and that's getting rid of mass incarceration, ending the drug war, getting rid of cash bail, and having actual police accountability. And then the third, you know, very important thing to me is fighting corruption. And I've seen it, and I've seen it up front, and I've seen the underbelly of Illinois corruption, and the unfortunate truth is it still goes on. I see it every day as a committeeman. The wheeling and the dealing and basic bribes that are going on every single day in judicial campaigns all the way up to, higher campaigns. So this is something that's very important. We have to fix these things, and the attorney general can do those things.
How would you go about doing that?
Well, as far as corruption, the first thing I would do is set up a public integrity bureau. In New York, Eric Schneiderman's the attorney general. And that's one of the first things he did was set up this Public Integrity Bureau, which is number one role and the only job is to fight corruption. So that's really the most important thing. You have to make it a priority. So Lisa Madigan, who's the current attorney general, she's not running, but she said in 2003 that corruption, you know, would be something very important that she would look into, even if it meant investigating her father. We're now in 2018 and really nothing's been done on corruption. By the attorney general. So we have to set up a unit. We have to dedicate the resources and the attorneys to look into it, be willing to prosecute it, be willing to investigate it. So that's sort of the back end of corruption and the enforcement level. But there's also the transparency level, which is working hard with the public access counselor to make sure that we have open and transparent government. And that's through FOIA requests and the Open Meetings Act, which, you know, there's unfortunate backlog within the attorney general's office that needs to be fixed so people's FOIA requests are actually heard and resolved.
You mentioned the Trump administration. We have seen Lisa Madigan join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. How much of a priority would that be for you if you were elected attorney general taking on the federal government?
Well, I don't see it as taking on the federal government. I see it as standing up for the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Illinois and the residents of the state of Illinois. I don't care if it's Trump or anyone else. If you are an affront to the Constitution, an affront to democracy, attorneys general need to step up. And they shouldn't just be joining with other attorney generals as far as, you know, filing briefs. They need to be out front, standing up for our democracy. So I will be very vocal. I will be very active. And where we can join, we'll join. But I won't wait for other state attorneys general to actually step up and do anything. I will, at every step of the way, I will fight Trump because he's quite frankly a tyrant and we need to stop him.
You've mentioned a few things as important for you: criminal justice reform, mass incarceration, cash bail, corruption. If elected Attorney General, what are the most important priorities for you to focus on?
Yeah, it's those three, the standing up to those big powers, the criminal justice reform, real criminal justice reform, and fighting corruption. Those are the three main priorities. And Lisa Madigan's office has been very competent. It's a well-run office, and they do a lot of good things. I am not trying to upset any of those. I'm not trying to withdraw funds or dedicate resources in some different place. It's a matter of focus, and it's a matter of inspiring the office to fight for something more and be bold myself as Attorney General to fight for those things and those priorities I mentioned.
And can you explain a little bit more about what your priorities would be in terms of criminal justice reform?
Yeah, so number one is, and it's linked, it's mass incarceration and ending the drug war. As Attorney General, you are the advisor to the legislature. You have the bully pulpit, and you have the investigative powers to implement a lot of these things. So the drug war is one of the worst domestic policies we've had in the last 50, 60 years. It's done nothing but harm people. We throw people in jail and in prison. They're not rehabilitated for the most part. They have an addiction or they're caught with just some amount of drugs, and the next thing you know, their life is ruined. This does nothing for the taxpayer. This does nothing for the individual caught, and it doesn't even reduce addiction rates. So it's a flawed policy that we need to work to stop, and Attorney General can do that. Number two, and sort of number three, because the first two go hand in hand, mass incarceration and ending the drug war. But the other one is cash bail. And as a Cook County public defender, I've been working with all the stakeholders in Cook County. We've recently been able to get rid of the cash bail program, which basically says that someone could be sitting in jail because they can't post $100. That, again, it's not good for the individual who's awaiting trial. They're innocent till proven guilty. And the taxpayer, we're now paying for that person to be housed because they have some low-level criminal offense. It does no one any good to do that. So we need to get rid of that system where we focus on, is this person a flight risk? Is this person a danger to the community? If the answer is no, then you let them be out during their trial or wait for their trial. And then, you know, however they get sentenced, they get sentenced. But we're saving money. We're allowing the process of the justice system to work out, and it's a win-win. The final piece to the criminal justice reform is police accountability. And so when Barack Obama, President Obama, did the study, the U.S. Attorney General studied and investigated the Chicago Police Department, and what they found was many, many abuses that were going on for decades. In the Chicago Police Department, they set up a federal monitor to evaluate and basically fix these problems within the Chicago Police Department. Then Donald Trump became president, and he withdrew. So Lisa Madigan has now filed suit. And with that lawsuit, she's asking for a consent decree. I agree with that, but we need to go further. The community must be involved. And I'm proposing that the community groups, would have enforcement power in this consent decree.
We just have about a minute left, and I just wanted to ask you one last question for our audience. Our listeners outside of Chicago may not know that you were elected committeeman of the Democratic Party in Chicago's Albany Park neighborhood in an upset against an incumbent who outspent you and was firmly part of the Democratic establishment. This time for this race, there's a crowded field of seven others who are running for this primary for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Why should voters choose you?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, when I became committeeman, I ran against Dick Mell. He was the committeeman for as long as I was living, and at the time I was 40 years old. So it was completely unheard of. People laughed when I said I was running. The thought of going up against Dick Mell was just a joke. So no one thought I could win, but I took on the machine, and I actually won. And while I was running, his people approached me and said, if you get out of the race, we'll make you a judge. Now, mind you, a committeeman is a volunteer position. You don't even get paid. A judgeship is paid nearly $200,000, but I refuse to take that deal because of what I believe in. So that's why the voters should vote for me. I've been a public defender much of my life. I've been standing up for everyday Illinoisans. I'm the only one who has fought for actual individuals as an attorney. I'm the only one with a true progressive agenda. that will really change Illinois and make us move forward. And I can do it. I've shown that I can do it electorally, and I've shown that I could do it as a lawyer. And that's why they should vote for me.
Aaron Goldstein is a supervising attorney with the Cook County Public Defender's Office. He's also a Democratic committeeman in Chicago's 33rd Ward on the city's north side, joining us from our studio at Northwestern University in Evanston. Aaron Goldstein, thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much.
About 3 years ago, a man named Jim Vernon was teaching chess to a group of kids and their mothers in Morton, just outside Peoria. One evening, 19-year-old Dustin Brown entered the room where he was teaching, wielding a knife. Jim was able to subdue the attacker and make sure everyone else got out safely. And so this year, the Carnegie Hero Fund awarded Jim Vernon a medal for these actions. The award recognizes people who performed heroic acts in civilian life in the U.S. and Canada. And Jim Vernon's on the line with us now. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st. Jim?
Yes. Was that question directed at me?
It was. I said hello. I just wanted to say hello. Jim, I don't think anyone goes into a weekly chess club expecting to fight off someone in this. What you did there, do you mind sharing what happened?
What was the question again? I'm sorry. I have a little problem hearing.
I was asking if you mind sharing what happened to you that day?
Well, it's a routine day. Every once a week I go conduct chess instructions and coaching and chess club for homeschooled students. They're not attending the public schools. I do this in the public school, too. It's a volunteer position. But at the public library, a friend of mine and I have arranged to have equipment there, and another friend talked me into coming in to help them. And after about 5 years, it's kind of part of my life. Not all year round, just through the winter during the winter months. In any case, came in a normal day, and you can just walk into the library. There's no security or anything there. It's an open public building. And security, there's a sign there that says you're not supposed to bring guns in. In any case, about halfway through the day's session, the door opened suddenly, and some individual with a headband wrapped around him and a knife in each hand ran in, yelling about he was going to commit murder. He's going to kill somebody, is more of a direct quote.
What did you do?
Well, first I took a look at him, trying to decide if this was some kind of a really sad Halloween joke. This was in October, so it could possibly have been. To make sure that I understood that, he started cutting his left hand with his right hand. He had a knife in each one, but he was carving himself very slightly, but enough to bleed. I decided he was serious, and I was going to have to do something. I tried to talk him down. I'm a peaceful person, normally. And walked towards him as I did that, and speaking in a soft voice, and asked him some questions, which he answered. Life sucks. I hate high school. I don't go there anymore. Stuff like that. And after, I just kept trying to subdue him vocally, not physically.
Yeah, and that didn't work, it
sounds
like.
And I said to him, I gave the people in the room a cue. I said, let's sit down here. And I did not know his name, of course, at that time. And I'd ask him, and he was from Morton. And I said, let's sit down here. We can talk some more. I'll listen to your what you've got to say here. And because these kids have to leave now. And I started a couple more steps, and the leader of the mothers who organized and bring the children to this club, and there were about three or four of them present, including her four, I think, in the room, took the cue and up, and she said, come on, let's go. And the kids went without saying a word.
Wow, so you were able
to... Like a little scared rabbit.
Yeah, Jim, that's amazing.
And the mother's right behind them.
That's amazing that you were able to talk him down and to save all of those kids. Who knows what would have happened. Jim, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for being able to share this story with us. Jim is a recipient of the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission Award for his actions. We've got the full story. I know the Peoria Journal story, Peoria Journal started a whole story about this. So we'll tweet that out for everybody to listen to if they want to hear more of that story. But Jim, thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, to find more information, past conversations, contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day. Thanks for listening.